Peter B. Collins with News and Comment here on Monday, May 21st. The lights have gone out for the Bee Gees lead singer Barry Gibb. Bee Gees had a long recording career, Three Brothers Gibb, and while I was never a big disco fan, I have to acknowledge that the work they did on Saturday Night Fever and in that era was some of the best of that genre, and it sold a boatload of records. I am still fond of the early years of the Bee Gees and songs like Massachusetts, and I hope that people will remember the entire catalog of Bee Gees hits and not just the disco dancing tunes. Well, in Chicago, the NATO summit is in its final hours as I speak to you here at about 4 o'clock California time on this Monday, and it's been quite a wild weekend. Certainly, the lockdown of Chicago by Mayor Rahm Emanuel in preparation for this event led to tensions that did bust out, and on Sunday there were protests that resulted in about 45 arrests, and four officers say they suffered minor injuries. And that's kind of par for the course in a hard-headed city like Chicago, where the cops can be extremely brutal. But the big news is really about what appears to be another setup. Another bust of alleged domestic terrorists, this time labeled anarchists, and the story doesn't add up. In the Bridgeport section on the south side of Chicago, yes, the H in south is silent, on the south side where Boss Daley lived for many years, Bridgeport is a working-class neighborhood, and even as the original Mayor Daley served, what, almost 30 years, he never moved to a different neighborhood or a bigger home. He and his wife, Sis, lived there until he died. And this is the scene where three individuals were arrested with great fanfare. And as you may know, I work part-time at a corporate radio station here in San Francisco, KGO. And they're affiliated with the ABC Radio Network. And on the air on Sunday morning, I explicitly challenged the network news coverage and the breathless report from correspondent Aaron Katursky, because they took the Chicago police line hook, line, and sinker. And from what we can find out so far, and we'll be exploring this further, we will hopefully get an interview with Michael Deutsch, whose soundbite you're about to hear. Michael is an attorney with the People's Law Office and the National Lawyers Guild. And he's been on our program before talking about the domestic terrorism investigations that occurred in Chicago and other cities in September of 2010. And these were situations where people who'd been working on peace activism in different parts of the world had their homes raided, their computers taken, and it was a significant brushback of these peaceful protesters. We're still waiting for an actual trial of these individuals for the alleged consorting with terrorists that they have been accused of. But Michael Deutsch is representing one of the three defendants, and the defendants say that they had beer brewing, home brew equipment to make their own beer, and that they were infiltrated by a Chicago police informant, who then proposed, apparently, that they use the beer-making equipment for Molotov cocktails. And this is a pattern that we have seen far too many times, where in this hyper-police state that we now live in, the cops feel they have the liberty to infiltrate groups and then put them up to criminal actions that they were never considering. Here's a quick soundbite from Michael Deutsch, and as I mentioned, we will we have a request in for an interview with him, and as soon as some of the dust settles there in Chicago, I'm sure we'll get his account of what has occurred.
What we've learned now, we believe it is a setup, an entrapment to the highest degree, and it is sensationalism by the police and the state to discredit the protesters that have come here to nonviolently protest.
So, as I mentioned, we do have a request in to speak to Attorney Michael Deutsch, and I hope to bring that to you in a podcast sometime this week at peterbcollins.com. So, to the photo op meeting of NATO leaders, convened in Chicago. What's the purpose of this? Well, it's to send a message to the American people. And here's what President Obama had to say, quoted by McClatchy Newspapers. It says, for Obama, the timetable allowed him to boast that the alliance was unified behind a vision of a future after 2014, quote, in which we have ended our combat role, the Afghan war as we understand it is over, but our commitment to friendship and partnership with Afghanistan continues. He went on, quote, we still have a lot of work to do, and there will be great challenges ahead. The loss of life continues in Afghanistan. There will be hard days ahead, but we're confident that we're on the right track. Now, I consider this to be a head fake, because with November's elections in mind, the president has been building a case that we're actually leaving Afghanistan. And note the language. They talk about combat troops being pulled out. But we're going to have a presence, based on his commitment to Karzai and the meeting in Kabul on May 2nd, through 2024. And the idea that the Afghan military and police are ready to, quote, stand up as we get out, is simply bullshit. And we all know it. That's why France has announced that they'll be leaving Afghanistan by the end of this year. And the Secretary General of NATO, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, is trying to put a positive spin on this. The agreement reached on Monday at the NATO summit, quote, will allow us to gradually and responsibly draw down and withdraw our troops, but we will remain combat ready until we have completed our mission. And this just doesn't pass the fundamental smell test here. We know that the Afghan military and police are heavily infiltrated by the Taliban, and that many of the members in uniform are drug users. Hashish, heroin. And we know that they show up on payday, but often don't show up at other times. And to imagine that the illegitimate government of Hamid Karzai, with this army and police force that cannot perform, that they're going to be able to control that huge and vast nation, it just is not true. And so we're trying to spin our way out of Afghanistan. As I mentioned in Friday's commentary, the White House is trying to lower expectations about what success in Afghanistan actually means. And in the meantime, this meeting was intended in some ways to put pressure on Pakistan. The invitation to President Asif Ali Zardari was extended at the last minute, hoping that Pakistan would relent and agree to reopen the supply lines to Afghanistan, which they closed following November's raid that killed 24 Pakistani troops. That was an American-led operation. And here's a comment here from the Washington Post coverage of the NATO summit. It says, in his remarks opening the Monday meeting, Obama pointedly thanked members of the Northern Distribution Network, a collection of Central Asian nations who are now allowing NATO supplies to pass through their territory and into Afghanistan. It's the long way to Afghanistan. And it describes Zardari as looking on uncomfortably as Obama thanked the countries that form the northern route, which is far longer and far more expensive than going through Pakistan. Now, as part of the deal, Pakistan is demanding cash. They're turning this route into a huge toll road, and I believe the figure I saw was they want $1 million a day to allow American supply chains to traverse these routes. And I believe that's called extortion. But in war, I guess you do what you need to do. Here's a quote again from Secretary General Rasmussen. As Afghan forces step up, our forces will step back into a supporting role, training, advising, and equipping our Afghan partners. Now, as we train and advise, many Afghanis are turning on NATO forces with their guns and killing them. And the bottom line here is that this is all hinged on making a deal with the Taliban. And I don't think the Taliban is interested in a deal. They're going to hold out as long as possible, even if it's 2024, because they have a completely different mindset and worldview. And when you think about this myth of training the Afghan army and national police, think about Peter Van Buren. He's been on this program many times. He is the guy who's on the verge of being fired by the State Department for his book called We Meant Well. Go to his website, wementwell.com, and you can get a sense of his commentary. But I recently spoke to him when I was sitting in on the Carell syndicated radio show. It was just last week. And I asked him about the Iraqi police force and the Iraqi army, and that the U.S. is dialing back significantly its training commitment in the current year and the next year. And he said that it's just a waste of money, and that essentially the Maliki government uses the army and the police to crack down on Sunnis, the minority religious group that dominated when Saddam Hussein was the dictator there in Iraq. In Yemen today, a very violent situation in the capital of Sana'a. There was a military parade being rehearsed near the presidential palace. A suicide attacker, disguised as a Yemeni soldier, entered the group, blew himself up, and at this time, at least 96 people are believed to have been killed and 300 wounded. And Yemen is another scene of American military action and drone strikes. The witnesses say that the attacker walked from the western part of a square dressed in military clothes, detonated a suicide belt just before the defense minister and his subordinates had been expected to greet the troops. Is this, as the corporate media in this country is leading us to believe, an action of Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula? Maybe. Or is this blowback? Revenge for drone strikes. We've been using them quite liberally in Yemen, most notably to kill the American citizen and his two sons, Anwar al-Awlaki, for whom we offered no charges, no proof, not even, you know, a public representation of why he had to be killed. And speaking of drones, I want to recommend to you, in the May 14th issue of the New Yorker magazine, a lengthy article by writer Nick Paumgarten. And he talks about the use of unmanned aerial vehicles in the United States. And he says, he's got a clever line here. He says, the legal issue of domestic drone deployment is itself a little like a drone. It has stolen up on us and is now hovering noiselessly overhead. And in the article, he describes how President Obama signed a law recently that requires the Federal Aviation Administration to have plans in place by 2015 so that unmanned aerial vehicles can fly without hitting private aircraft or commercial airliners or military aircraft. And that management of airspace is an important issue. But the issue that nobody's talking about is whether this is constitutional and whether it is appropriate. And Paumgarten leads his article with a story from Lakota, North Dakota. less than a year ago, last June, some cows wandered onto somebody else's ranch, the Brossard Ranch. And the Brossards apparently have a reputation locally as living in their own world. They're armed and they don't like outsiders. And so when the cops came to try to recover these cattle, Mr. Brossard Sr. refused to turn them over. And when cops threatened to go on his property, they said, Brossard reportedly replied, "If you step foot on that property, you're not walking away." So they tried to tase the guy, and an altercation occurred, and ultimately the cops retreated. But the next day, they came back with aerial support from a Predator drone. Let me remind you, this is in North Dakota. The drone was used to surveil the ranch, which is a fairly big piece of property, so they could locate where the Brossards were, and they ultimately, with that air support, arrested them. Palmgarten goes on to say that the lead company that has developed some of the really small aerial drones is based in Simi Valley here in California. That's where the Reagan Library is. And a company called AeroVironment, spelled A-E-R-O-Vironment, is developing a lot of things that, on the one hand, appear really cool technologically and appear really scary when it comes to our constitutional rights. They're making these drones that are, especially compared to the big predators and the raptors, they're small, cheap, and they are almost indestructible. They will break up when they land, but they can be easily put back together. And these drones can carry a payload of a high-powered camera or a weapon like a shotgun or a missile launcher. Here's a description of the Puma, an 8-foot wingspan, a weight of 13 pounds, a propeller on the nose, and a camera in its belly. Like a mini glider, it can land on water. And these have the potential to dramatically change law enforcement and the privacy rights of individuals. Because some of these drones fly so high that you cannot see them, you're not aware of them, but Big Brother can be watching. He says that there are inexpensive and remarkably agile drone toys already on the market. A French company called Parrot sells a popular remote-controlled, video-enabled quadrotor drone, controllable by an iPhone. It costs just $300. Now, currently, if you own one of these little drones yourself, you're not allowed to fly them higher than 400 feet. But who's out there to enforce those rules? Over the weekend in Libya, it was announced that Abdel Basset el-Megrahi has died. He is the man who was convicted in a very questionable legal proceeding of being responsible for the blow-up of Pan Am 103, which was destroyed in the air over Lockerbie, Scotland, in 1988. And he was finally brought to court and convicted in a proceeding that most people understand, most people have paid attention, was a predetermined lynching. And I don't pretend to know who actually was responsible for blowing up Pan Am 103. But today, the New York Times, in reporting his death, finally acknowledged that the case against him was very weak and that the conviction lacks great credibility. And Robert Perry at ConsortiumNews.com has written a great piece about that. I recommend you take a look. And we have an email in to Bob Perry to invite him back on the show to talk about this, and we hope to do that in the next few days. The Supreme Court has agreed to address one of the biggest controversies related to surveillance of American citizens. This is wiretapping. And it relates to the 2008 renewal and so-called amendments of the FISA law, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And there's a very interesting back and forth underway between judges on the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit in New York. And as you may have heard us discuss before, one of the issues in all of these cases is called standing. Do the plaintiffs have a cause of action that allows the court to hear their case? And they have to prove that they have been harmed or that there has been some cost to them from the law that they are challenging. We discussed this with Carl Mayer related to the detention aspects of the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. So in ruling for the plaintiffs that they do have standing, Judge Gerald Lynch wrote that they had a reasonable fear that their sensitive communications would be monitored. They had taken costly measures to avoid being monitored, and he said that was enough to establish standing to challenge the law as a violation of the Fourth Amendment's ban on unreasonable search and seizure. The full Second Circuit declined to rehear that ruling, but it was a tie vote 6-6, and the chief judge, who likes wiretapping and is not concerned about your Fourth Amendment rights, said that the suit was frivolous. He compared it to a plaintiff's allegation that the CIA is controlling him through a radio embedded in his molar. He went on, "The only purpose of this litigation is for counsel and plaintiffs to act out their fantasy of persecution, to validate their pretensions to policy expertise, to make themselves consequential rather than marginal." Well, you arrogant son of a bitch, Mr. Judge Dennis Jacobs. I'm sorry, because we know that our government is monitoring virtually every phone call, virtually every email, and this is a dramatic violation of our Fourth Amendment rights. And with judges like that, there's little question as to why we are losing those rights. Over the weekend, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, the board of directors voted to endorse the right of same-sex marriage. And this is a major breakthrough, because African Americans really are the largest group of people who are largely opposed. I think something like 40% of African Americans polled are opposed to marriage equality rights. And this really harkens a hopeful development as the barriers break down and people recognize the obvious discrimination against same-sex couples who wish to marry. Over the weekend on Sunday, there was a solar eclipse, and it was really interesting. I, of course, did not watch it with my naked eye, but I watched it on TV, and we took some pictures and looked at those. But it was one of the best uses of Facebook that I've seen since I joined Facebook 2 or 3 years ago. There were so many people who put up cool pictures, most of which they had taken themselves, of the lighting effect of the eclipse and pictures of the sun itself as it went into a nearly full eclipse mode. So I found that pretty cool, and as I say, one of the better uses for Facebook that I've found so far. And finally today, I've got the quote of the week from presidential candidate Mitt Romney. And I have read this several times, and it cracks me up every time. The context is he was talking about the threat by the Ricketts family, who have a super PAC, to use their super PAC to buy television commercials that would bring the Reverend Jeremiah Wright back to American television screens. And this, of course, is a way of trying to defeat President Obama by linking him to Reverend Wright. And this is quoted in the New York Times. Reporters brought up Mr. Romney's comment in February suggesting that Obama wanted to make America into a less Christian nation. Asked if he stood by that comment, Mr. Romney said that he did. Quote, "I'm not familiar precisely with exactly what I said, but I stand by what I said, whatever it was." I'm going to read that again. "I'm not familiar precisely with exactly what I said, but I stand by what I said, whatever it was." Oh, Mitt, what a brilliant thinker you are. Hey, thanks for listening to today's news and comment. Visit my website at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until